is barred from streets and highways. Stay in your homes. Stay in your homes.
Live from the Forbidden Book Group Studio in Duffeltown, USA, it's Necronomapod with your hosts, Mike Stoffel and Mike Moncada. Episode 17, Charles Dickens, A Christmas Carol. The story of a man, his three favorite ghosts, and the little crippled child who loved him so. And now, Necronomapod!
Ebenezer!
Merry Christmas, and God bless us, everyone.
Or happy Hanukkah, happy holidays.
Quasi Kwanzaa. or fantastic Festivus. To all of you all.
So hey, to all y'all.
To all y'all. So welcome to our special holiday edition of Necronomapod. So this week we are talking about one of the towering classics of macabre and weird literature.
Yeah, we're quite brave to be taking on this.
I know, because people have actually read this. We can say anything we want about most of the books that we talk about, because
people haven't read this book. I'm guessing people have seen.
Two weeks ago, had you read this book?
I had not read the book.
2 weeks ago, I had not read this book.
Much to my shame.
I know, I was a little embarrassed, but
I've read other Dickens.
I've read quite a bit, yeah, but never
and
this
I've
one.
I've been a little Dickens, but I've never...
and I have a record by Little Jimmy Dickens. That's a little old-time country
watch
music joke
for you there. Story with Angie Dickinson.
But never actually had reread Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol.
Let's see what the whole title is, because there's...
Oh, you dig it up. Girl. Yeah, well, that's a Christmas Carol is just a short version.
It is. Well, no, I don't know. I have to go look it up now.
We're flipping pages.
Vamping.
Please, vampires. Please bear with us.
Oh, I didn't say.
Bugger.
It is. Yeah, I'm missing that page.
Somebody ripped the page out?
They ripped the page
out. Wow, see, I didn't actually read it. I listened to it. Twice, though, which is like
Christmas
reading.
Carol, a ghost story, or something like that. Correct?
Yeah, it's actually a pretty long title.
I'll say it
in five staves or something like that. Mm-hmm. So we decided to take on A Christmas Carol because it's probably the most famous ghost story in Western literature. I can't think of another one. Maybe Hamlet.
Yeah, I was thinking Hamlet.
But
Or the ghost, isn't there a ghost that appears somewhere in the Bible? The Witch of Endor writes a ghost.
I don't know.
Yeah.
And it's Casper.
Yeah, it's the oldest and friendliest of the
and
ghosts.
Friendliest of the ghosts. What was Casper when he was alive?
He was a little boy with a big head.
He must have been.
They never talk about, how did Casper die?
Yeah,
I know. Was he murdered?
I think that subject comes up in the movie Stand By Me. It's like, what was Casper when he was alive? He's a ghost. It's a good question. Oh. It is. But anyway, in the Christmas Carol, it's a ghost story. And so we decided, because we are Necronomapod and we discuss all things horror, we decided to take this on as a horror story.
Yeah.
So here we are.
Mm-hmm. So that's it. And thank you for listening.
So our first question is...
Oh, is this a call-in show?
Yeah. Well, it's like our first caller.
Hello?
Anybody, just give us a call. Call us up. Number is. Anyway.
Well, I have to say that... Are we getting into the book?
Let's get into the book. Because I think we should talk a little about
the ghost story tradition.
This is something that I learned about. I don't know where I learned about it. I just learned it. But I did learn that telling ghost stories was a 19th century British tradition, for a Christmas tradition. It's what you did around the fire at night. You know, it's the darkest, getting close to the darkest, or just past the darkest night of the year. And you built a nice roaring fire, and you sat around, and you told ghost stories, and that was a very Christmassy thing to do.
And were they all more, or were they all ghost stories that had like more a morality
yes.
undertow to
yes.
them?
Yes, and overtime? Actually, to prepare for this this episode of Necronomipod, I actually located one of these ghost stories. That this ghost story was the one I read. It was called "The Uninhabited House" by Mrs. J.D. Riddle. And it was actually
I read about that in the Lovecraft.
Might have. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And it's it was actually published in Dickens's magazine, the special Christmas issue that year. The magazine was called All the Year Round. These magazines would publish like a special, like kind of like the New Yorker does. They'll publish a special double issue,
mm-hmm.
They would always put ghost stories in there, at least a couple. And this was the one. One of the ones for that year, and you know, the edition that I read doesn't actually specify the freaking year. Very annoying. But it must have been when All the Year Round was being published. So I'm guessing in the 1860s, maybe it was published. So it was after the Christmas Carol. But it's a real ghost story. It's kind of scary. It has nothing to do with Christmas. There's no, Christmas doesn't happen in this story. It all takes place in February.
The Valentine ghost story is a very rare
Valentine's
tradition.
Day ghost story. And it's, you know, and it's a haunted house story. You know, it's something bad happens in a house, and this young lawyer's clerk, out of love for the young heiress who's set to inherit the house, decides to stay there and figure out what is driving all the tenants away. And he eventually figures it out and, you know, sets the ghost to rest and marries the comely young lass and inherits everything. So it's, you know, it has a happy ending. But it was an example. I kind of wanted to see what these Christmas ghost stories were like. You know, did they have something to do with, you know, Christmas? And not necessarily.
Right.
But Dickens's story, which is, you know, predates the one that I read by about 20 years, really does. It kind of sets the tone for a certain kind of Christmas.
Certain,
yeah.
I also recall that Andy Williams mentions telling scary ghost stories
mm-hmm.
around the fire in his holiday song, which I could sing, but I won't.
Which song is that? what's the title of the song though? I was trying to remember.
It's
that.
The holiday season.
It's the holiday season.
And whoop de doo and tickery tock.
Oh, I know that one. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe if we're lucky, it'll be hanging off the end of this podcast.
It could be.
Like some sort of growth. Yeah, but there is a line in that story. That's where it comes from. That's a tradition that's pretty much died out.
When the Canterbury Tales, mm-hmm. when was that written?
Canterbury Tales are written in the, I want to say the 1300s.
Because those are ghost stories, aren't they, some of them?
I
don't know if they told those at Christmas, but I always thought that they did.
No, those are stories that were told at the King's, at the Elizabethan, I mean not Elizabethan, at the court of King Richard II.
There were some ghost stories.
He was a trust, I don't think so. You may be thinking of the Decameron. There's a lot of stories in that one. There's all kinds of stories. And those are from about 80 years before that.
I wonder what the connection between Christmas and telling ghost stories.
It is. I did some clicking around. I wasn't actually going to go to a library to figure this kind of stuff out. I just, you know, decided to
what's a library?
Siphon through the intertubes to find out where this tradition came from, and I couldn't find out. But I know it was very strong during Dickens' time.
Well, and if you think about it, our Christmas traditions, for the most part, were formed in Victorian England. For the most part, the way we conceptualize Christmas,
it's fairly recent. I mean, Americans have put their own spin on it.
It's kind of a smudging of German and
Yeah.
But the Victoria was from the House of, she wasn't Windsor, right? She was.
Oh, I don't know.
Habsburg? Was she Habsburg? I mean, they were German.
Yeah.
I mean, so.
Yeah.
Sure. So that got probably transposed over into England somehow, parts of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that was, you know, of course, it's way after. But so I'm wondering if maybe just that's what the masses did when they had holidays, is tell.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
stories anyway.
Yeah, I mean, you know? the idea of sitting around a fire and reading aloud a ghost story is, I don't know, that feels kind of cozy to me, you know?
Yeah, it does.
It kind of does.
It's kind of family time.
It's family time, yeah. I mean, these ghost stories that they tell aren't like bloody bones, like, you know, cannibal Holocaust stuff. it's not hostile too. It's scary, but... but really insubstantial ghosts. It's
so like Hitchcockian. Haunting.
Yeah. It's like a Christmas Carol.
It's like
Christmas Carol is a very inoffensive ghost story. There is other moments in this story in the Christmas Carol that actually like are scary to you.
Okay, so this is a good point because I was thinking back to the person that I was reading and his definition of horror.
Yes.
And that there's a monster of some sort, that it's repulsive, unnatural, and that that the characters in the book, in the art, they are the ones who feel terror.
Yes.
You might not necessarily feel terror reading it, but the characters. So you cue up that. So, did the character of Ebenezer feel terror?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Did I feel any sort of horror or terror when I was reading this book? You know what? A little bit.
A little bit.
A little bit.
A little bit. There's but a couple of moments. But you know what?
I'm guessing if I hadn't been... I mean, part of the problem with this book is that it's so ubiquitous. It's so part of our way
it is
of thinking, and that in the images that from movies and such.
Yeah.
So having to, and I feel like I did a pretty good job of sort of pushing that to the side.
I as tried best very as you hard. Can, yeah.
And just reading what was there and trying to experience what was there on the page.
That's one of the reasons that I listened to it twice, is because I wanted to make sure that I really got the words in my head, that I had two readings of it in me. To sort of like push aside all the stage plays and the movies and the Henry Winkler and the version.
And the George C. Scott
and American Christmas.
And
Bill Murray's Bill Murray.
And I think there was a version with Marlo Thomas.
I think there was two.
There was a female Scrooge.
Patrick Stewart did it as a one-man show. Just on a quick side note, The Philosophy of Horror is by Noel Carroll. That's with two R's and two L's.
A Christmas Noel Carroll. Noel Carroll.
Noel Carroll. Wow. That's awfully strange that we would finally decide to look up that guy's name today, of all days. Noel Carroll.
So, with his definition, there is horror. Mm-hmm. And I think as a reader... Now, Ebenezer Scrooge, this is a curious thing about Ebenezer Scrooge for me.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Two things. One is that he's mostly remembered as being the miser. You're being a Scrooge.
Yes.
But really, he's a redeemed character who's a generous, open-hearted
soul. And you see him, the miser part kind of break permanently about 30 pages into the book.
Close to it.
Yeah. And for the rest of the time, he's on the path to reform. In fact, near the end there, by the time the third spirit comes along, the third spirit is unnecessary. The third spirit is actually kind of cruel.
Well, the third spirit pounds the nail in.
Oh, I mean, it's kind of, you feel bad for Scrooge at that point.
I don't, because I think he needed it. I think he needed
a little bit of punishment.
He had the sentiment, he had the past, he had, you know... his regrets, and then he needed to have, he just needed to be cold cocked.
Yeah, that's right. A good swift kick to the gut.
And so, in a way, that original, I mean, it wouldn't be horror as defined by Carol, but, you know, watching a man degrade, because what you see from the initial opening of the book, and then, you know, you see where he becomes what he becomes.
Yes.
From his past.
Yes.
To watch that happen, there is something horrifying in how a human being can degrade to that point where they are cold-hearted and closed off.
Yeah.
And his behavior is repulsive. He is like a monster in a way.
He's a monster.
Is he an unnatural monster? No, he's a very natural monster.
He's a very natural monster.
But
as far as the supernatural elements of the story, there were two parts that I kind of focused on as like real good set pieces of horror writing. The appearance, the build up and appearance of Marley's ghost.
Yes.
Was really well done.
Mm-hmm.
By anybody's standards, and it's still scary today. His face appearing in the knocker,
yep.
At the front of the building. This is a description of this cold, these cold apartments.
That are rented out as offices.
Yeah, he's basically living above offices. That aren't so heated. Cheap,
he's
and
rented
dark.
Out all his.
Oh, I know. It's terrible. It's terrible. He has no home. He has a place where he parks a bed. He eats at his club. And that's it. He just stays there until he has to sleep, and then he goes home and like sleeps. He might as well be living in a cardboard box.
Yeah.
For the amount of heat and warmth that he allows himself, it's horrible. And then the approach of Marley's ghost with the doors clanging and the steps approaching and the chains
ringing.
And all the bells ringing at once and then being quiet all at once. Those techniques. I mean, it's almost cinematic. The way that Dickens,
it
writes its own screenplay. In fact, it really does. I'll get to that point later.
And that, it's funny because Scrooge is portrayed as being very, he's not nonchalant, but he's quite, with the ghost, he's kind of a, teases and pushes and
yeah.
He's kind of pesky, but inside he's feeling terror. But
he's really
his outside.
Yeah,
he's sort of like crotchety. And,
I know, but that breaks down pretty quickly. Eventually, he just says, "You know what? All right, this is the way it's going to be."
Well, you know what doesn't is that Marley unstraps
his kerchief.
The kerchief around his head, and his jaw drops to his chest.
I know that was great.
And that scene where he's like, Marley, you don't get a sense of what Marley's eyes are, but there's something, they must be vacant or something, because when Scrooge pulls out a toothpick and says, "Do you see this toothpick?" And Marley says, "Yes."
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, "But you're not looking at it." He says, "Nevertheless, I see it."
Oh,
and,
right.
And you're like, what is this?
Yeah.
What is this ghost?
Yeah.
What is he really seeing here? Because
I know it's really it's just the little details like that are really pretty creepy, and I have to hand it to Dickens because
Dickens' description, his little details and his descriptions of things, spot on.
Oh, they're spot on. The description of Dickens' house. I remember this.
Dickens' house.
I'm not Dickens of Scrooge's house, saying that it was like it doesn't really seem to belong in the neighborhood. And he said, "It seems as though it had run there when it was a small house and gotten lost and was never able to find its way out of the neighborhood."
Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah, it
that's
really
great.
Is.
And he's full of that. Yeah, he's one of the Dickens. I don't know if you can tell, is one of my favorites.
He's always one of my favorites too.
He's always been.
Yeah.
Anyway,
and I think with Marley, you know that scene where his jaw—you never see that in a movie.
No,
because that probably would be gross and horrifying in a way that they don't play to the horror so much. And
it's kind of like the joke that in speaking of the other possibly more famous ghost story in Western civilization, in the English language, Hamlet, is that the joke that the gravedigger makes in Hamlet,
when he pulls out Yorick's skull, yeah, he says, "Oh, well, that's quite." Oh, actually, Hamlet says, "It's quite chopfallen, I see," which means that his jaw's lower jaw is missing.
Yeah.
Ouch.
Yeah, who knows? Maybe Marley has coins on his eyes or something. He can't.
It could be.
He can't open his eyes.
It could be. The other, but it is near the end of that scene when Marley departs. He backs up towards this window, which all by itself lifts up, and he just gets sucked out the window. And outside the window, there's all these other spirits who are being tortured because they want to
engage
help
in humanity.
Yeah,
they want to
help humanity. They want to do something good in the world, and they can't because they're dead.
Well, the other thing is when Marley says to Scrooge, you know, I don't know why I'm able to be here. Basically, he says, I don't know why I'm able to be able to see me because I'm around you all the time.
That was the other
and
moment.
Scrooge is like, whoa!
Yeah, this is, you know, thinking back over this past 7 years, because Marley is 7 years dead, Christmas Eve, 7 years, that he's been sitting next to him this whole time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Shiver. Yeah. That was good. That was a good horror moment for readers and Scrooge alike.
And then there's this the character of the Christmas past,
mm-hmm,
which usually in the movies is a woman wearing like candles on her head.
Like a Saint Lucia.
Or she's holding a candle. She looks like an angel almost.
Yeah.
But this creature, except for the Mr. Magoo Christmas Carol, which they come as close as
towering classic.
As they come as close as possible to this androgynous sort of alien character
that
keeps kind of morphing in and out.
That was a surprise.
And it's also
to
very
me
too. Very cinematic also, and him trying to describe this thing that's there and not there, depending on how you focus on it.
I kind of thought it was like she's like a candle flame, constantly changing.
I didn't think of it as a woman. I thought of it as a male.
Yeah, well, that was surprising. I always think of it as a woman because it's usually cast as a young woman.
An Art Deco woman.
Yeah, an Art Deco woman. Something out of a Klimt painting.
Yeah, kind of.
But it was very surprising in this to say, oh, this is like very... very interesting way to describe this spirit,
right?
Because the next spirit is,
because I'm kind of wondering what the Dickens was trying, is it, if it's an allegory of something, what is it an allegory of, the spirit, the description of it? Because there's this light coming out of
light
his head,
coming out of the head,
and he's holding a cap and he has a belt of holly of some sort, and then these rings of flowers, spring flowers around the waist of his, around the hem of his tunic.
Yes.
And he looks old and he looks young at the same time.
I know, it's very, it's
so I
very
suppose
strange.
It is. I suppose that probably does describe the past, because you're your age now, older and young in your memory. And Scrooge wants to, they never talk about this in the movies either, but Scrooge wants to, like, would you please tone that light down a little bit? And the ghost is like, you know, why? You're going to, like, suppress my spirit?
What I have for you?
Yeah, what I have for you.
Yeah.
Scrooge tries to put that light on. Yeah. He can't.
Yeah, let me just say this. Before we shut this down, I want to talk about things that we read in this book that are never portrayed in the other versions.
Well, that's a good idea.
Yeah, so we'll get back to that.
Right. Are we gonna do that now?
No, we can. Let's talk about the spirits. So the first spirit, the second spirit was
like everybody knows,
it's this big bearded guy with a holly.
He's showing his boob.
Yeah, showing his hairy chest. And he's got a horn of plenty thing that he's.
But he also has the scabbard, not a scabbard. This isn't in the movie, I don't think. He has like a hilt.
Uh-huh.
A rusty hilt that's not, doesn't have a sword in it.
Weird.
Yeah. Did you hear?
No.
Didn't you remember reading that?
No.
Yeah.
I miss
Is it called a
times?
Hilt?
Like a scabbard?
Yeah, a scabbard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. An empty scabbard.
An empty scabbard, and it's rusty, and it's on his...
Yeah.
And I don't ever remember seeing that in the movie.
I like...
And I don't know what that stands for.
Yeah, it's actually quite mysterious. It's very... it's like Dickens is playing into like the symbol system that we don't understand anymore.
Yeah. And How about scary? The two, I always was creeped out by the two creatures clinging to the Ghost of Christmas Present's legs.
Want and
ignorance.
Oh, yeah. See, well, that's one of the things that never shows up in the movie versions.
That I can remember. No, one of them, I think the oldest one.
Really? The one from the 40s?
I'm pretty sure. There's like really? Two children with hollow eyes holding the ghost's legs.
See, that's my favorite movie version, but I haven't seen it since I was probably in middle school. So.
And it's that thing where the guy throws his words back at him. You know, aren't there?
Oh, yeah, I know. That was... Ugh.
And that's also like a little like punch in the gut.
I know. I was like, well, maybe he should just die and just decrease the surplus population. Right. Like, ooh, snap!
Right.
In your face, Scrooge! Burn!
Well, and there's another scene in that in this book that I don't remember seeing much in the movies because Christmas Present takes him all over the place.
Yeah, there's a couple of scenes that they never touch on.
Coal miners' place.
Yeah, they never go. The movie versions never go to the coal miners. They never go to the
grocer or the butcher.
The grocer or the butcher. They never go to the ship.
Yep, the ship
on the sailors and like well first the lighthouse and then out to the ship. They never. Do they ever, that scene that we were just talking about where Marley gets pulled out the window into the swirl of all these other...
I don't ever remember that.
I remember
him sort of disappearing.
Yeah, he just sort of disappears. So it's a really good scene. And it must just be too expensive or I don't know why they'd never do it, but they should. Because it's good. It's very effective.
Mm-hmm.
Other scenes that they never do... they always show him when he's a little boy. They always show Fezziwig's ball.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is so great.
Well, and I sort of remember, now, is this in the play or is this in a movie version? Where
I don't know about you folks, but here in
Dublin,
I'm pretty sure every town has this. But Doppeltown has the Christmas Carol playing at the Tyrone, what should we call it instead of calling it his real name? The Ghost of Theater Past Theater. every Christmas they have
I think
it.
Every theater company, they shake their moneymaker for that one.
Exactly.
That's how they bring it in.
That's how they make
it's
their...
It's the pasties
yeah.
on the...
It sells the out every freaking year. Anyway.
But... I forgot what I was going to say.
I am
what
so
was I
sorry.
Talking
should,
about?
We, should we rewind and find out?
No.
No, you were talking about...
I was so...
Bugger.
Drunkenly interrupted.
Yeah.
I was talking about the scene that is never shown. Oh, where I've seen in other movies or whatever, and it kind of gives an insight into Scrooge's character.
Yes.
Is when he... there's some kind of business transaction or business dealing where he takes Fezziwig's business away from him or usurps that somehow.
Really?
Yeah, I remember seeing, it could be in the play or it could be in one of the movies.
Wow, that's cold.
Yeah.
See, it's not in the original book that we just read.
He and one of the guys, the other clerks.
Yeah.
Or somehow he screws one of those clerks over or one of those guys gets screwed over and that's how... Scrooge sort of ends up climbing up the ladder even more.
Oh, which see, now that's a good addition. That's actually I would say that's improving on Dickens.
And the other scene that they were in Christmas Present or was it Christmas Past is where the Scrooge sees his girlfriend.
Yes,
now married
with all those kids,
and the husband says, "Oh, I saw Scrooge, and he was all alone."
I know that,
which is also very
that was chilling.
It was
pretty chilling.
And
every one of those scenes. I mean, even literally the first time that Scrooge is taken out by one of the spirits. Now, none of the spirits are ghosts. There's only one ghost, major ghost in the story. Everything else, all the other ones are spirits, whatever that means.
Aren't they called ghosts? They're called ghosts.
Are they?
Yeah, I think. You keep talking.
I don't know. Besides when Marley gets drawn out the window and you see all those other ghosts swirling around with their various chains of, and you know, like that one guy has a safe that he's dragging around.
Yeah. Oh, and he knows him.
And like, he knows him. Oh, yeah, I remember that guy. Yeah. Ooh, glad I don't have to carry a safe around. Anyway,
I guess they're all called spirits, quite frankly.
The spirit of Christmas. Even
the
past,
last one is a spirit.
Yeah, spirit of future. But there's only really
one. Oh, no, Marley's ghost. Marley's the ghost.
Marley is the ghost. So I don't know what if I had a point there, but probably it was a distinction. I was making a distinction
between ghosts and spirits. Yes. What is the distinction?
Well,
the spirits were never dead.
The spirits. I mean, the spirit of Christmas Past is this weird amorphous androgynous.
Almost, I kind of think he looks like E.T. a little bit.
A little bit like E.T.
E.T. would play him in the
movie.
Sure.
So, what about the spirit of Christmas yet to come?
I don't think I'm ready to go to that yet. Is there anything else in the present that is that?
Well, one thing I noticed, and this was very surprising to me, you do not know Bob Cratchit's name until well into the book. I always think of the story of the Christmas Carol as it's a story of Scrooge's relationship with the Cratchits. And it's not. And it's not.
Yeah, I always think of like Scrooge buying all these toys and
bundles
and bringing them over and having dinner over at the Cratchits.
He buys the big frickin' turkey, but he gives it anonymously. I think in some versions he like presents it. He like brings it over. Not in the original. The Cratchits never know where that big damn bird comes from.
Well, you never even see the Cratchits enjoying that bird.
No, you don't.
So you have no idea what happened.
Yeah. Because
they're pretty much... They pretty much drop out after Christmas present.
Yeah. I mean until the Cratchits are literally not named until you get through. I mean, he's there. He's just the Clark. He's sitting there and he's on a stool and he's...
Did you say Clark?
I did.
You little British.
It's Dickens. It would be a clerk in an American bank, but it's a Clark in Dickens.
Okay.
I deserve
I'll see you in hospital.
In hospital. I'm going to take the lorry.
I have to go to the loo.
Well, if you want to get to the loo, you want to take the lift. Up to the first floor, which is the second story.
Let me get my brolly, because I have to... goes upward.
Your bumper shoot?
So anyhow...
All right, sorry. A little British interlude there. Sorry to... Are any British listeners?
I'm cutting that out.
Snip. So, he's just this guy sitting in the office, you know, wrapped in a comforter, and with no name. He's not even given a name. I wonder, because Dickens frequently wrote these things in numbers, he would publish the first part of his novel before he had written, sometimes even halfway through it. He would just, you know, trust that he was going to be able to tie up things.
But it makes sense because Scrooge wouldn't have thought of him as a person with a name.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. It makes sense after the fact. It makes a lot of sense after the fact. But I wonder if that was a happy accident in this case.
I don't think so.
That he hadn't gotten around to just naming him.
No, I don't think so.
No? You don't? No? All right. Okay. I'll give you that.
I want to give Dickens the credit.
All right.
Because you know it's very planful in his.
I mean, you know, it makes total sense. It was just very surprising to me. I was like, I think that's Bob Cratchit, but how come they're not giving his name? Well, eventually they do.
Well, and the other thing, do we ever really know that his nephew's mother died in childbirth? Or do we just hear that she died young?
She dies young, yeah. I think that's entirely too delicate of a subject to put in print.
But you kind of see where Scrooge doesn't like his nephew because of what happened to his mother. That's how I always interpreted that.
I never thought of that. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, he's very dismissive of that jolly young pauper.
There's a line that he says to Scrooge, like, you know, because Scrooge will say, "What are you so happy for? You're poor." And then the nephew says, "Well, then, why aren't you happy? You're rich."
Oh, it's snap! Scrooge is like,
"Burn!"
Scrooge is like, "What?"
Zing. I know that's good one-liners.
But it's this great description of in the Christmas present where some guest at the nephew's house isn't have the, they're playing Blindman's Bluff and his
Buff, yeah.
And the blindfold isn't on tight enough and he's like chasing after the plump.
The toper.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's chasing after
he's purposely touching nice, her and brushing her.
Grabbing onto her. Yes, yes, yes. Really he would end up in court these days.
I think Dickens, even though he can be very sentimental, I think he has a and can paint really broad characters. Yeah. I think he has a good eye for human beings.
Yes.
You know.
He really does.
And the little eccentricities and the little those little nuances and those little and how people can kind of set themselves into a caricature. Because people do.
They do, yeah.
You know, just look around us.
Yeah. So speaking of this of Dickens' sentimentality, did it bother you at all as you read through this?
I did not feel like it was sentimental, I have to tell you.
Really?
I did there was, not.
It would creep up once in a while. The character of Tiny Tim, which is a character that I love, but I have
if
to...
If he was a real child, I would smack him.
With his own
quite
crutch.
Frankly. Grow a pair, Tiny.
Grow a pair. What do you mean you're glad you were at church and people were gawking at you because you're a cripple?
You know what? I have to tell you this. Maybe it's my mood. That really touched me.
See, that's exactly right.
It really.
See, that's the
it
thing
really
that,
was
that's
effective.
A, that I think is the thing that pisses me and like other people off about Dickens' sentimentalities because it freaking works.
It does. How it's again, it's like one of those.
I feel you get manipulated and you kind of after
does
the fact you resent it, but only after the fact. So yeah, Tiny Tim is like Oliver Twist, but even more pathetic.
That was one of those. There was I have you know there were a few times in this book where I sort of blubbered.
Oh really?
All openly, you know, at the coffee shop.
I just shed one manly tear.
And that was one of the scenes.
Oh god,
it was bad. You know.
I was getting.
Well,
I
it speaks. I was this book, frankly, it speaks to my curmudgeonly feeling about. I might as well go through. I go through this story every year, probably in my life, beginning at Christmas. I hate Christmas.
I do too.
Rah rah rah! And at the end, oh Christmas, the spirit lives in me.
I'm still very much a Scrooge, and by Scrooge I mean. Like
the penny pincher?
The penny pincher.
And would you please turn the heat up in here for the love of Christ?
No. Here, let me get you a comforter. No, get your own damn comforter.
What's your name?
Whatever your name is.
But, yeah, I think Dickens has an insight to people and what we do with these days.
Yeah.
That, is probably not a new thing. I mean, I don't think.
Or it could be one of the things. As I was listening to this again, I was thinking maybe my reaction to this story because it's a reaction that's just it's very like childlike for me.
Yeah, it's ancient.
Is because I've known this story since I was a little kid, and those stories that you know when you were a little kid, especially when they have like strong emotion. Like really sad bits and really happy bits. Right. If you go through them again, you'll be 5 years old again.
You kind of are five years old.
Yeah.
But I think, especially in this day and age, depending on your religious proclivity, that the idea of, you know, there's this time, one day of the year, 2 days of the year, where some people in some part of the world are saying, this is an ideal of...
Yeah. Lay down your guns.
Yeah. Wish each other well.
Yeah.
Give each other things.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, open yourself just a little bit.
Yeah, just a little bit. Yeah.
And I can go with that.
I can go with that as well.
I think that's all Dickens is saying.
Yep.
You know?
Pretty much. Pretty much.
And... He says, if you don't do that, what kind of person will you become?
Yeah.
You know, what are you going to be dragging around?
Yeah. You have to do this while you're alive.
Yeah.
Because when you're dead, it's Too feckin' late.
Who knows? Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Too frackin' late.
Too frackin' late. Are there any other bits that
Ghost of present in the present?
Well, yeah, Ghost of the Present.
Hmm. Is there anything else that the Ghost of the Present?
I think we touched on the like the major points. There is that.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. So then the Ghost of the Future,
yes.
The spirit of the future.
Yeah. Now
why the Christmas future is a scary ass
is death
cloaked to death.
I know it's death.
That's what I want to know.
Doesn't speak.
I kind of wonder what he looks like in there.
Yeah.
Or she.
He or she, yeah. Or it.
Yeah. Some bony.
Yeah, there's a
fleshy thing.
Quick little anecdote of the local theater. Because the theater puts it on every year, once in a while they'll hand it to somebody who just says, you know what? I'm really going to blow this play wide open. I'm really going to take it to the edge. So at our local theater some years ago, I didn't see this.
No.
I've heard stories of it. They decided to make this really edgy production, and The Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come was on stilts. It was like this 20-foot tall or 15-foot tall specter. Really scary, really huge, you know, terrifying.
Yeah, little kids crap their drawers.
Yeah, exactly. No, but one particular performance, and this is, you know, the audience is like, oh God, this is so preachy, so heavy-handed. This is just really un-Christmassy. Things went horribly wrong, and The Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come comes out on stage, clomping along on the stilts, and maybe the actor on the stilts had a little too much to drink beforehand, but the equilibrium wasn't quite there. And at one point, it must be near where the spirit points to Scrooge's gray. All of a sudden you hear inside the thing, whoa! And just falls completely over.
No.
Sprawled out on the stage. No. Oh. And how do you get up from that? You have to like be on those stilts when you go out on stage. You can't just like, you know, climb back on them in the middle of the stage.
Probably, your feet are probably tied.
Yeah, it was one of the theater moments for the ages.
So how did it finish it off? It just crawled around.
I don't know. It was just, you know, gales of laughter from the audience. You know, they're throwing cups of wassail at them. Anyway, so The Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come is supposed to be scary. Just hooded figure.
Yeah, he's the scariest of
bony
all.
Bony hand. Why? Yeah. Why is Christmas Yet to Come so dreary and forbidding?
Right.
Because, you know.
Well, it's to teach him a lesson.
I guess.
I guess because all Christmases yet to come will end in death.
Apparently. Yeah.
There will be some Christmas that you're not going to be at. Yeah, it's pretty much the
end of all stories. That's probably it.
You think he just had a little ornament hanging from his. Does he have
no
sickle?
No.
But you think of him with a sickle,
yeah,
you?
Or a staff or something.
Or something. I wonder if he has a little sprig of holly on there. Or
could
something.
Be.
Or,
could be. Or just
or like, a Santa with red eyes that.
animatronic death Santa.
But they don't describe him with a cane or a sickle. So I mean, it's
just some. Yeah, they don't describe him much at all.
He's a cloaked figure.
He's a cloaked figure. You can see hands and the cloak, and that's about it. Doesn't speak.
Get a sense that he shrugs his shoulders.
Yeah, you see it like the barest of nods. And the only question where it gives any kind of ambiguous answer is the last question that Scrooge asks it, which is, is there anything I can do to change this future? And it sort of goes, meh. We'll see. He gives the meh.
He shakes the magic eighth ball
and says, ask again later.
There's a scene in my mind where I think the movies do it differently. Because in the book, it's not in the book. In the book, the women are at, you know, with the pawnbroker, for the lack of a better word.
Yeah.
And they're selling all these things.
The receiver of stolen goods.
Right. And they're pulling things out, and she pulls out the curtains and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes in the movies, you see that woman actually tearing the curtains down. Yeah. And there's something, if you've gone to enough estate sales, which I have, There's something really horrifying and disturbing about
the vultures descending.
The vultures descending on these goods, and yeah. Who gives a damn about this person's life?
Yeah.
Give me that silver spoon.
Yeah.
Give me that Kodak camera.
Ooh, an umbrella stand.
Yeah. And it is like that.
Yeah.
With the dead.
Yeah.
There is no...
That scene.
And it's always disturbing.
Yeah. Yeah. That scene was really well done, I thought, because you have these, like, it's kind of like the... Like a bunch of witches telling his fate or something like that.
Right.
It's these three people that
they are like himself. The three witches.
Yeah, they're like and they're like these three crones just sort of telling over his guts basically. It's like this is all you have left.
Yeah.
You know, we have everything you held on to so tightly all your life. We just
Even the bed curtains.
You
took the bed curtains and the blankets.
His shirt. He was dressed in a shirt, and she undressed him and put on a different shirt. Took it off of his dead body and put on a calico shirt and took the good linen one with.
So that goes back to your idea a couple of podcasts ago about sort of the desecration of the dead.
Yeah.
And there it is.
Yeah.
Right there.
Yeah, I know, and the fact that he thought he wanted to control so much of his life, and that in the end he's just a piece of cold meat laying there, and he can't do damn thing about it. He just has to lay there and take it.
And he doesn't even
I mean, at that point he doesn't know.
He knows.
You can't be
idiot.
That stupid. Yeah, I think
who are they talking about?
I know he must be
a spirit. This poor man.
Yeah, he's looking at Abu Simbel. He's right next to the Nile.
But that scene is creepy, and it's not as creepy and as scary. It's not creepy in a. But again, so it's the ghoulish. Humans as it's that's the perfect word for
yeah, it's
it.
It's ghoulish. It's a ghoulish scene,
and it's also ghoulish because it's very. They do it in such a business-like way.
Yeah, too. I mean the whole thing is just cold. The two conversations. You know, he has that one conversation with amongst three businessmen, one of whom's got something hanging off of his nose, which is kind of creepy.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just like, well, I guess he's dead. I don't know. Should we go to his funeral? Sure. Tell you what, let's just all go to his funeral. There'll probably be a lunch. We'll get some food, and that'll be it. It'll be a good business move, because all he was to us was a business thing.
Yeah.
That's all he was. Yeah. And the second conversation he listens in on isn't even that deep. Just like, I guess old Scratch got his due. Yep. That was it.
Uh-huh.
Wow, that is the sum of your life.
Right.
That is as deeply as you have scratched yourself into existence.
And then interestingly, he contrasts that with Tiny Tim.
Yeah.
And the people grieving.
And a little life. Yeah, just a
little
life.
A very short life. And the effect on people.
Has marked so many people so deeply. Yeah. I know.
I never thought of that as being that was a contrast.
I didn't either until you just mentioned it. Actually, that was good.
Yeah, thank you.
Good. So you can't see it, but we're shaking hands right now. I'm congratulating him. I'm awarding him a medal.
So. And Tiny Tim was very present to the world.
Yeah.
And the people around him. And,
yeah.
There it was.
So then we get to the fifth and final stave.
So would it be horrifying to you to see... your grave, and to know that, would you want to know what people would say about
my grave would not be scary, because I have friends who have a grave. I mean, they have a plot, they have a stone, they have their name, and they have their birth date carved on that stone. That wouldn't freak me out. But the second part, being able to hear what people say about you when you are gone.
And people rummaging through, I think people rummaging through your things.
Yeah.
Because all I could do was think about when my grandmother died.
Oh, yeah. Was there a feeding frenzy?
Oh, my.
I know.
If she was there, she would have been, oh, my God.
She would have broke her rolling pin over somebody's head.
She wasn't even buried. She was still at the mortician's funeral home. Yeah. And people were going rip. I just People ripping drawers just being dumped on the floor and these things.
That same thing happened with my grandmother some years before she passed away. Yeah, no, it was awful. We some of my family members had gone into grandmother's house when grandma was still there, still living there. And you'd pick up like an old antique piece of crystal or behind a painting on the wall, and somebody had written their name on a piece of tape and put it on there.
If you took out grandma's dentures, somebody's name.
Put somebody's little piece of masking tape. It was very unseemly, and it caused real damage within the family. That damage that persists, and she's gone now, and everything has been parceled out.
But that is the lesson, right? Of how do people?
Yeah, and grandmother knew it was happening, and she said, "She's like, I just wish it would stop. I just want them to stop. I will give it all away. It's all yours.
But I'm still here.
Don't fight."
Yeah,
I know it was upsetting.
Yeah. And so, I mean, it's another great insight Dickens has into people.
Yeah.
And all it was is he reaped what he sowed.
Yeah. And for Scrooge, it was even worse because he didn't even have family to do it. It was servants.
Right.
It was like literally, people that he probably didn't know their name. Like he didn't know Cratchit's name, apparently.
Right. He was just the charwoman.
The charwoman. They don't get names in the book at all.
No, they don't.
Yeah.
They don't.
And they just, he breathes his last. They check his pulse. And they start tearing the curtains off the bed, pulling the rings off his fingers, taking the buttons off of his shirt.
His blanket. He took his blanket.
What was
the scene where who says, I foresee a lonely corner with crutches and no owner? Is that in The Ghost of Christmas Present?
Yeah, it's Ghost of Christmas Present. Yeah. Scrooge asks him, will Tiny Tim live? And he says, I see... crutch leaning in a corner with an empty stool.
Yeah, unless somebody intervenes or something. Or does he say that?
I don't think he does. Yeah, he might. I can't remember.
Anything else? Anything surprising in that?
Stave four.
Yeah.
No, I think they. I mean when they do it, they do moving. Adaptations of it. I mean, it moves pretty fast, and they pretty much cover it all. They have the Cratchit scene, which is so heartbreaking. They have the conversations, and then they take him to the graveyard, and they show him his tomb. I mean, his gravestone. And then, I think in the movie version, my favorite movie version, the one from the 40s, just like in the book, he is holding on to the spirit's arm, and then suddenly he wakes up, and he's holding on to his bedpost.
Yeah.
That's what happens. Yeah. And then he wakes up, and then the rest of it is...
It writes itself.
It's actually pretty giddy, and I really like the final stave. When you have I get to live. I have a chance to change.
Yeah.
Which is...
And if you give yourself over the story, you go with it, too.
Yeah.
Because it's like everyone has a chance to change.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, as long as you're still alive.
Right.
And it's really powerful.
It really
it's
is.
It's a really powerful
It really is. It really is.
And it's so great, you know. And I have to, the version that Dickens wrote where, he talks to the urchin down in the street and he has him go buy the turkey.
Oh, what a marvelous boy. What a wonderful boy.
And he buys the turkey and he sends it to the Cratchits, but he doesn't tell the Cratchits who it's from. It's an anonymous gift. And he's kind of just messing with their heads, which is
because he has it all planned that Bob's going to come in and he's going to rip him a new one. And then, you're late. I'm going to give you a raise and I'm going to help you with your family and get that Tiny Tim, some doctors.
But he doesn't, I mean, he preserves the class distinction. He doesn't like show up at the Cratchits with this stuff. He does it all anonymously, and he goes to his own nephew's place.
Yeah.
He wouldn't think of presuming to like step down his in his class and drop in at the Cratchits.
All right, I don't agree with you, but okay. I wouldn't.
It doesn't come. He doesn't even mention. He doesn't even nod a toward.
It probably isn't about the class. It's just that. Doesn't know them.
True.
You know, he's the boss.
True. Later on, he does.
Yeah.
And so, and
takes Bob out for a drink.
Yeah, exactly.
And he calls him Bob.
He properly introduces himself. He breaks the class distinction, and then he does it. A lot of movie versions or other versions, they'll sort of combine those two, and he'll like show up with a turkey.
Yeah, like Scrooge goes to two parties that day. Is what it seems like.
Yeah, which is he's double booked and he's really busy. He's running around, and which I hate. I always have to go to two parties. Anyway.
Oh, Uncle Scrooge!
But what else? He plays his cruel joke on Bob.
Yeah, his last little dig.
His last little
before
dig
before he finally.
He literally digs when he like hits him in the waistcoat with his elbow,
and then this is a good time because at the end of the book, True to form with us.
Yeah, he invites Bob Cratchit out for what?
A cocktail time! All right, what is the cocktail? The Christmas cocktail.
Well,
a ghostly spirit of cocktailness.
I will tell you as soon as I find it here. We're looking.
I think it was amazing that Scrooge during a business day would invite. You know what surprised me, quite frankly, is that they got paid. Because Scrooge was complaining about, you're off Christmas Day and I still have to pay you.
That was surprising.
And I
think in some versions,
that
versions
really surprised me.
Yeah, in some versions, I think the implication is that he doesn't get paid.
I don't get even paid on Christmas Day. So
well, I do. And on Christmas Eve, and on New Year's Day, and on President's Day. But of course, I have to work that day. Anyway, the cocktail this week
is
Smokin' Bishop. But because this is a Necronomicon pop, we're going to call it Bloody Smokin' Bishop.
Very good.
So Smokin' Bishop.
Get out your paper and pencil because
it's a little complicated and you need to plan ahead.
But it's quite delicious.
Well, yes, indeed it is. We've been working on this for a week. So, Smokin' Bishop, which is what Scrooge invites Bob Cratchit out to have a bowl of at the very end of the book. Smokin' Bishop is kind of like a wassail or like a
glug.
Glug, yeah, like a Northern European glug. Smokin' Bishop is a warm wine mixture. What you do is you take. Here's the recipe. It says, take 6 Seville oranges. Now, here in Doppeltown, Seville is a long freaking way away.
So we're thinking blood oranges.
Yeah, blood oranges. I would take, it says here, take 4 regular oranges, but take 4 blood oranges if you can get them. And regular oranges would be fine.
And I would also say throw in a bunch of kumquats.
Oh, that's a good idea. Some kumquats. Yeah. What you do is you take these oranges or kumquats. So 4 regular oranges. And a large grapefruit, that's one version, or take a bunch of kumquats. I would say like a good half pound of kumquats, just the kumquats. Or finally, I would say use 6 blood oranges. Yeah. Those are your 3 options.
I would do 5 blood oranges and 10 kumquats.
All right, and Mike Mercado with 5 blood oranges, 10 kumquats. Anyway, whatever you decide to use, take those. And put them on a cookie sheet and put them in the oven on low heat until they sort of get white or like pale brown. They should caramelize a little bit.
Yeah.
Start to release their sugars out of the skin.
Yeah.
And then take those things out and then in each of the oranges or like put 5 whole cloves or like just pick a bunch of the kumquats and say use 20 cloves or 30 cloves.
All 2 eyes to each goldfish.
And then put them along with 1/4 pound of sugar and a bottle of red wine. Just mix them all together in a bowl, cover it, and keep it in a warm place for 24 hours. Then, 24 hours is gone. Take the cover off. You have this weird smelling citrusy, winey thing.
pull out all the fruits, and this is going to be a little more time consuming if they're all kumquats. You're going to want to squeeze all the juice out of them into the wine. Then put the whole mixture into a saucepan. You know, pour it through a sieve into a saucepan. Very important. You don't want any seeds in there. And then bring it and add an entire bottle of port. So you have a bottle of wine and a bottle of port. So you're in for what? Like already you're in like $25.
Yeah.
And
you can use a cheap bottle of wine. Because yeah. I would. Yeah. I wouldn't use an expensive bottle of wine.
Yeah, use a cheap bottle
of
wine.
It's like a sangria.
Yeah, and you can get a cheap bottle of port too.
And that's why they made these things. Is they took cheap liquors and
made them better.
Yeah.
Made them drinkable.
Yeah.
Anyway, take the bottle of port and then put it, you know, so you have this saucepan with these two bottles of wine and all this citrus juice. And you want to heat it up, but do not boil it. And once it's warm, serve it in warmed mugs. And careful, because these things will sneak up on you like you would not believe.
I would also make a suggestion. We didn't do this, but when you're doing the fruit in the oven, I would sprinkle sugar on that.
Really?
Yeah, because one, it will extract some of the juice.
Mm-hmm.
Two, it will caramelize it quicker.
Sure.
And you're adding the sugar, some of the sugar already into the...
Yeah, I put a little bit. I would be careful not to put too much because somebody's going to have to clean that pan, and you do not want to have to clean caramelized sugar off of a cookie sheet. It's really, really hard.
Well, if you throw a little wine on that cookie sheet once you're done, mm-hmm. and you take that, sort of deglaze it, and throw that in with the wine, it'll be fine. Oh, yeah.
All right. That sounds good.
And that's just another level of flavor.
Yeah. So anyway, it is... Very tasty.
Serve it in a bowl.
I would keep
it. Drink a bowl of.
I would keep it in the pot.
Soup bowl.
I'll keep it in the pot so you can keep it warm. Actually, what I like to do is keep it in a slow cooker. Just to keep.
But they
warm.
Drink it out of. He takes them out for a bowl of bloody.
Well, yes.
Smoking bishop.
That sounds good though, isn't it? Bloody smoking bishop. It could be the coolest name of a drink that we have. The Smoking Bishop. And we didn't even make it up. I mean, that's actually a real
drink. And then Scrooge and Cratchit must have just got blasted.
Oh,
and they were just arms around each other.
Arms are sliding on the eyes.
R.S. J. Barry, gentlemen.
Throwing up on the lamplighter's shoes.
The Ghost of Christmas Vomit. The little known
ghost of Christmas Vomit. Anyway,
I just got visited by the ghost of Christmas Vomit.
I was driving the porcelain Christmas bus. There it is, the cocktail. Drink
bubble
and
bubble.
Bubble bubble. Holiday cheer. Horrible holiday cheer. So
there. And
what else do we have?
I do have to say there was a scene in the book that they don't really talk about in the movies, for sure. And it's definitely Dickens' voice.
Uh-huh.
Well, first, you know what also surprised me is that you get the sense that you're being told a story.
Yeah, Dickens does that. Every once in a while, he'll sort of push the characters out of the way and he'll talk to the readers directly.
Right, because at the beginning, he's like, you know, Marley's dead. Make no mistake about it. Marley is dead. And there wouldn't be a story unless Marley was dead.
Yep.
But there's a scene in there where he's talking about and I forget if it's in the past or in the present. It's in the past when Scrooge visits Fezziwig.
Right.
And the ghost of the spirit is sort of nudging Scrooge is sort of like, you know, look at him. He wasted probably 4 pounds on all this. And, you know, what a waste of time. And Scrooge is like crying.
I know.
And he's saying, but here this man, when a boss has the power to make your life miserable or to make it happy or to bring, you know, there's so.
Exactly.
This boss holds this power. And boy, did that, I'm even as I'm talking about it, it just sent chills up me because
I know.
He was so right about that.
I
never thought about it that way.
The institution that I work for, just this year, it has been made official that there can be no official or unofficial end-of-the-year celebrations by the company. It's not a company. It's a public institution. Because it's a public institution. And that's the most anti-Fezziwig thing that they could have done.
No end of the year. What do you mean, no end of the year?
Well, we used to have the holiday party, which was, you know, you take off the afternoon. We go to a restaurant, something like that. We go bowling or something like that. We have a little white elephant gift exchange, and everybody have a couple of beers and some free food, and that would be it. It'd be great. Right. You know, we don't get bonuses or anything like that if we have a good year or anything like that. Right. That was kind of it.
Right.
And that just got taken away this year. And everybody, including the bosses, you know, it wasn't the boss's decision. You know, it's a very big institution. So and the damage it has done to morale is incalculable.
No, the way to suck joy out of
the
way you see this Fezziwig and the contrast of Scrooge, you'd say, you know, this is when you're a boss, you're sort of given this gift of being able to affect people in a very important and deep and resounding way.
Yeah.
I mean, and you can either turn that into a hell for people, or you can make it, you know.
You literally control, depending upon the kind of work, half of their life.
And
of their daily, their weekly life.
Even more than that, because they take it home.
Yeah. If they take it home.
And they're gonna.
Then it depends. Yeah. I mean, if you're, you know.
Well, if you've been kicked around by your boss, you're going to go home in a good mood.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought that was boy. More people should.
That was
read that,
I know that particular part really resonated with me, especially this year.
Yeah,
I was like, oh, and it wasn't anybody that I know who rescinded this from us. Uh-huh. It's
somebody must have complained.
It's faceless bureaucracy.
Yeah,
it's
who doesn't
policy.
Think about people.
Who doesn't think about people?
And what makes
tick? And you know who it was? I mean, I can tell you. It doesn't think about people, and that the department that it came from was a department called Human Resources, which is, it's one of the more cold names to call.
Yeah, I've never been involved with human resource people. I've been involved a lot. I've never been involved with one that really understood
humans.
People.
Yeah, how people as individuals, they're something that you...
They understand policy, and that's about it.
Yeah, it's policy. Right? They work with policy.
They have very little insight
into
people.
Yeah.
And, you can purchase so much capital...
I know.
With
by
people.
Throwing a damn holiday party, a Christmas party.
Or even, you can call it just a party.
Yeah. An end-of-the-year party. That's what it was. That's how I've been called ever since I've been working there.
It's not even a holiday.
Yeah.
The end of the year.
Yeah, end of the year.
The end of the quarter.
It's like, you know, we're coming up to some time off, which is probably religiously motivated, but, you know, you go.
Yeah, the winter
break. Yeah. It's the freaking winter break.
Yeah.
Anyway,
grape. No, but I think what gives me sort of cold comfort is that these things, we always think, well, this is a new thing to our time. But no, this stuff was going on.
Yeah.
When was Dickens, when was Christmas Carol written? The 1800s.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the little vestigial Marxist in me steps back and thinks, well, that's very paternalistic at the same time. Like, you know, the Fezziwig is kind of like this, taking care of his charges, and, you know, I'm the boss, and so I have these responsibilities along with all of my benefits. But, you know, I don't really think that. But I can see where people would say.
But if you're the owner, you
it's
do.
It's very bourgeois. But it's okay, I'm very bourgeois.
Well, but those people didn't own the company, he did.
No, yeah, that's right.
He has the power to hire and fire.
That's right.
You know,
that's right.
And I don't know what happened in capitalism, but in communism, this is capitalism.
Yeah, yep, that's right.
The story is it's pure capitalism.
Pure capitalism. It's very, Dickens is the great middle class novelist. So,
yep.
So, have we done it? Have we talked the Christmas Carol up and down?
I don't know. Would you consider it horror?
It has light sprinklings of horror elements, but it's a Christmas story. It's its own genre.
It's
a ghost story.
And the ghost story is either precursor of the horror, right?
Yeah.
They're the great grandfather.
Yeah. But it's not like a gothic. It has like some of the gothic trappings, you know, the ghosts and the chains and the
the creepy old building and stuff like that. But just a few of those elements. The rest of it is very it's a Dickens novel about people at work. Really? People didn't write about like middle class people going to work very much before Dickens.
Why do you think the story is still, tons of stories have been written. Why does this one continue to sort of speak to people, and it gets remade, It's a Wonderful Life in some ways.
Yeah, like, It's a Wonderful Life would not exist without this.
Without
yeah.
the Christmas Carol.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
I mean, it's also the story, strip all the ghosts away and all that.
Yeah.
It, you know, the story of transformation when people have to face their.
Yeah.
I mean, that story is getting rewritten over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And,
I mean, It's a Wonderful Life is basically a visit from the third spirit, sort of drawn out at length. It's like, this is the life without you.
Oh, yeah.
This is life without you.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah. The third spirit once removed or something.
Yeah, kind of. what's the angel's name?
Joey Bishop.
Sure. No.
Clarence.
Yeah, Clarence is, you know, much less threatening than the Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come. Yeah. But I think it has something to do with, I'm trying to think of the other Christmas classics. You have the Rudolph story, which arguably, and that's, I'm talking about the television version, resonates as deeply, especially like with.
So it has to do with The Outsider.
Yeah, it has to do with The Outsider.
Yeah.
And it's a different kind of Christmas story, but it's pretty powerful.
It is in its own way.
Yes, its own way, yeah.
Yes, it is.
I'm trying to think of other Christmas stories.
Miracle on 34th Street.
Miracle on 34th Street.
Has to do with belief.
It has to do with belief, yeah. That's not one of my favorites.
And having a childlike spirit in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's the Twas the Night Before Christmas, the A Visit from St. Nicholas poem.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Twas the Night Before Christmas.
Right, I know what that is, but yeah.
It's really popular.
So yeah.
There is the Yes Virginia, There Is a Santa Claus editorial.
It's not really a story though.
No, but it's what else?
The drummer boy.
Wasn't there something about like a baby in a manger or something like that?
Well, that has all the elements it has. It has lowing.
Shepherds.
It has massacres of babies.
Yeah, that is sweet.
It has mystics with prophecies. Sort of having ghosts in their dreams.
Yeah.
Telling them what to do.
Yeah.
You have, there's little elements of, elements of horror.
Sure, you have visitations by supernatural spirits
who
are telling you your future.
And you get a sense of the, are they going to find the baby and kill the baby?
Yeah.
There's always this foreboding thing.
So I guess that counts as a Christmas story.
Yes, suppose it's the first Christmas story.
One could argue that.
Though, in a way, really, stories of virginal births and threats to those are ancient as all get out.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. And at the risk of opening up the whole can of Christmas worms here, that's... what did you get there? Oh, it's a can of Christmas worms! Goody.
All right. So that tale, of course, is enduring.
Yeah.
Christmas Carol is enduring.
Yes.
It has become an archetype.
Become an archetype. I have to say that it actually rivals, aside from like actually being in a church on Christmas Eve where this story is told, and necessarily I think because people kind of forget it gets sort of smushed away by all the other competing stories, which are very powerful. I would say the Christmas Carol story is for me, it's the one. That's the story.
And essentially, it's about how people treat each other. That's basically, and there's a spirit of that that lives in you that that is about.
I mean, in the
because that's the spirit. So you can't.
I mean, in the Christmas Carol, they talk about you know, but people being decent to each other, you know, having common human
golden rule.
Golden rule stuff. And they keep the Christ story, the birth story, kind of in the background. They reference it once
tiny,
in a while.
It's Tiny Tim bits. Is the only one who references it.
Tiny Tim references it.
They look at me, you know.
Yeah, and that's the pretty only much really it. The time. That's pretty much it. And they never talk about Saint Nicholas.
No, they don't.
Or Santa Claus.
There's no Santa Claus. Or
no,
like
no.
That. But Santa Claus really wasn't in back then.
And they don't really talk about presents.
No, there aren't presents. They're sharing a meal.
They're sharing.
They talk about how people are sharing this meal.
Yeah,
that's the thing that happens with the Ghosts of Christmas Present is that you're seeing these people with their whatever they have to share between them.
Yeah. Yeah,
whether it's in the coal mine and it's a little crust of bread or whatever.
See,
it is.
That's the part of Christmas I love.
Any last words
about the Christmas Carol? I think I'm done. I think
there's more that I could say, but I think after all this time we can end.
Yeah,
we should end. What's the book for next time?
I don't know. I'm thinking that we should read something big because I don't think we'll be around this microphone for a while.
Well, let's not discuss it here. We'll post it.
We'll post it. We'll have our usual arm wrestle and then we'll figure it out from there.
And so let's put a holly twig in it
and stuff its mouth with figgy pudding
and chop off its head and plant it on top of your Christmas tree as a lovely tree topper.
It's a lovely tree topper. So good holidays, everybody.
Feliz Navidad.
Feliz
Weihnachten.
Feliz Navidad. Joyeux Noël.
Schadenfreude.
We'll see you in the new year.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
There'll be scary ghost stories and tales of the glories of Christmases long, long ago. It's the most wonderful time of the year. There'll be much mistletoeing and hearts will be glowing when loved ones are near. It's the most wonderful time, yes, the most wonderful time, oh, the most wonderful.